if the subconscious mind and the spiritual realm are not the same thing, then they are certainly in the same ballpark. They're in the same arena. There's a difference between intuition and precognition. And I would say that intuition is in the realm of the subconscious mind, and precognition is in the spiritual realm. And I'm going to talk about how they're related and linked. Now, when it comes to intuition, this is literally just your subconscious mind storing information and then connecting dots, fitting puzzle pieces together so that next time you find yourself in a particular situation, you just know what to do, or you just know that something is a certain way. You don't have to think about it consciously because your subconscious mind has already processed the information. And the subconscious mind, in many instances, can operate much faster than the conscious mind. An example I would give you is boxing. So when you train and when you spar, you're not thinking consciously a lot of the time. If he throws this punch, I'm going to throw that punch. It's not how it works. Once you build up a certain amount of experience in sparring and in fights, your subconscious mind has recorded the data. It knows what happened the last time you threw a jab and you brought your hand back a bit too late. It recorded the data last time you fainted with a particular shot and your sparring partner, who you train with regularly, reacted in a certain way to that feint. Your subconscious mind records these things. You don't have to record it in the conscious mind. You don't have to take notes on a notepad. Next time you get in the ring, your eyes are looking, it's connected to your subconscious mind, and you just know instinctively what he's going to do because you've seen it before. This is the world of intuition. This is the world of the subconscious mind, where, as I say, the subconscious records data, processes it, analyzes it, and you can then use it moving forward. It then can help you react without having to process things consciously. Now, it goes without saying, not everybody's subconscious mind is as quick at learning patterns and as efficient at connecting dots. So for some people, when it comes to, you know, the analogy I just gave of boxing, it will take them 4 or 5 sparring sessions where they keep getting hit with a counter right hand over the low left jab before they learn to read the physical cues from their sparring partner to know that a right hand is coming in to get that left hand up. So some people have better intuition than others in a boxing context and in many other contexts. But we all have, to some degree, this ability to store the information in the subconscious mind. The subconscious mind processes it. It connects the dots so that we can react accordingly the next time we're in a similar situation. When the subconscious mind fails to do this, or when the subconscious mind hasn't processed something effectively or properly, we then have to analyze it in the conscious mind to figure out, okay, the subconscious hasn't figured this out. Let's bring it into the conscious mind and figure out what went wrong. What am I not doing right in this situation in sparring? Why do I keep getting hit with this particular shot? Let's watch it back on video. Where did I go wrong? And so on. Some fighters have to do far less of that kind of thing, the conscious thinking. They have to do far less of that than other fighters. I'm going to imagine that Floyd Mayweather had a very powerful subconscious that could connect dots, process information, and make split-second decisions, the right split-second decisions, from very early on when he started boxing as a kid. Opposed to someone like Amir Khan, whose subconscious was not as efficient, it wasn't as intelligent, and so on. So he would have had to do a lot more analyzing in the conscious mind, would have had trainers, coaches, etc., have to sit down with him more and teach him things that they wouldn't have necessarily had to have taught Floyd Mayweather. He would have done it more instinctively because his subconscious has figured it out. Now, there is a bridge between the subconscious and the spiritual. And that bridge is called the collective subconscious, or what Carl Jung referred to as the collective unconscious. I know there are still going to be people who struggle with the whole concept of spirit. So let me define the spiritual. Let me demystify it slightly. I'm defining the realm of spiritual simply as unseen forces which interact with and have influence over the physical world, which mainstream science has yet to discover or acknowledge. And think about it logically, rationally, those of you who are very left-brained. There are lots of different unseen forces that science has come to discover and acknowledge over the centuries, such as radiation, electricity, magnetism, and so on. These are things that we cannot see, but they interact with the physical world, and we have a relationship with them because we've discovered them, right? Science has discovered them, but they've always been there, of course. We were still interacting with some of these unseen forces even before science discovered them. We just may not have realized we were interacting with them, or we didn't understand the relationship that we had with these unseen forces. So it's not logical to assume that we've discovered all the unseen forces that there is to discover. Surely it's more logical to leave your mind open to the possibility that there are other unseen forces which interact with the physical world. As I say, science, mainstream science at least, has yet to discover or acknowledge. That is what I'm calling the world of the spiritual. Now, how this connects to the subconscious, as I say, is through the collective subconscious, the collective unconscious, whatever you want to call it. The collective unconscious is what allows flocks of birds to fly in formation, complex formations, and navigate across the sea and know where to go. Which unseen forces are allowing them to do this? Not only as individuals, but collectively. This ties into things like the 100th monkey syndrome and all that kind of stuff. Now, if you look at herd animals, pack animals, the subconscious mind or instinct tells an individual animal to stick with the group, because it will be safer. If you are in the middle of the herd, you know there's lots of predators around, you're less likely to be picked off if you're in the middle as opposed to if you're a straggler lagging behind. So safety in numbers is a logical thing to gravitate towards on a conscious, subconscious, instinctive level. But where the collective unconscious gets really interesting is when, at least from the perspective of the individual, they start acting in an irrational way. Perhaps you can make some sense of it if you take a step back and look at the behavior of the species as a whole, although sometimes you can't. And these are situations where the conscious and subconscious processes of the individual are overridden by the subconscious processes of the collective. Now, the reason that these things happen, and I'm talking about, for example, what has happened over the past 12, 13, 14 months, whatever it is now, during this whole coronavirus situation. Human beings have foregone their, and I'm not talking about all human beings, but many human beings, their ability to process things logically, rationally, and so on. And this has led to behavior, at least on an individual level, which is counterproductive. It has led people to do things that are actually going to harm them, rather than doing things that are going to preserve their life, actually harm their life. It's got people to behave in a far more reckless fashion with their own health. And it makes no logical sense if you're actually engaged in logic. This all springs out of the collective subconscious. More specifically, the manipulation of the collective subconscious. Some people talk about the madness of crowds. That's a title of a book by Douglas Murray, The Madness of Crowds. I remember back in 2011, observing the hysteria. And of course, hysteria is an aspect of the collective subconscious. This is one of the things that can manifest collectively, is hysteria. And there have been historical accounts of mass hysteria. And certainly, we're living through an example of that, maybe the greatest example in history of collective hysteria. And again, during a bout of collective hysteria, people act irrationally and in a fashion which is counterproductive, at least to, it would seem, the individual. Now, once the episode is over, you might be able to look back retrospectively and say, well, this incident actually helped the species advance. Maybe you could see it as a function of evolution, where some of the species, metaphorically or in some instances, maybe literally, had to fling themselves off a cliff. Perhaps they were surplus to requirements, perhaps they were dead weight in order for the species to evolve and advance. Some had to die off, kill themselves off, and so on. But at the time, certainly on the level of the individual, the behavior seems completely irrational and illogical, especially because had they not been attached to this collective unconscious, they likely would not have made the decision. And actually, let me rewind a little bit. They are constantly ruled by the collective subconscious or the collective unconscious, most individuals. They simply wait and see, right, on a subconscious level, what everybody else is doing, and they act accordingly. If everybody else is chilling and not worrying about whatever virus, they're going to chill, most of them. But if everybody else starts panicking, they're going to start panicking. It has nothing to do with anything they've read. It has nothing to do with anything they've seen in the real world. It has to do with the way other people are reacting. Okay? If most people weren't paying much attention to their televisions and it didn't really matter what the government put on there, then the past 12 months would have been very different. But because people do pay attention, that then has a knock-on effect. One person starts panicking, other people in the family start panicking. In other families, the same thing's happening because people are paying attention to the television. It's not the television. It's the reaction of the individuals based upon what they've seen on the television, which causes this domino effect of the hysteria, the irrational behavior, the counterproductive behavior. So, what is it that links people? And no matter how, certainly over the past 12 months, no matter how much information you try to present to a lot of these people and how logical you are, how much you try to engage their rational mind and their logical mind. They are still completely hypnotized, overwhelmed by this collective subconscious feeling. That's what's governing and driving their decision-making process. Now, you could talk about there are certain physical and visual cues that have led them to this behavior, but think about it, it's collective behavior which is counterproductive. By behaving in this way, they're going to become less healthy. By behaving in this way, they're going to be more vulnerable to predatory individuals within society, certainly the ones in government, high-level corporations, and so on. They're going to have less freedom. They're going to have less social interaction. So what I'm proposing is that there are unseen forces which allow the powers that be to more easily influence the collective subconscious and therefore the behavior of the masses. Forces which can get the masses to behave in ways which are counterproductive, counterintuitive even. Forces which can literally help to hypnotize the masses, to completely hand over all of their cognitive processes to those who would seek to manipulate them. To give you a very crude example of what I mean, let's just say there's a massive hole in the ozone layer, far bigger and far more severe than any hole that's ever been spoken about in science before. And you know where this hole is. You know that there is very, very dangerous radiation that comes through this hole in the ozone layer. So dangerous that anybody who resides on the part of the earth directly underneath this hole will develop cancer and die within a couple years. And so understanding that there are these unseen forces at work on this particular area of land, if you are an evil person, you could maneuver via manipulation whichever culture or group of people you want to exterminate, maneuver them onto that land through whatever manipulation, and they're going to develop cancer and die. So you haven't harnessed the radiation from the sun in terms of you haven't turned the sun in the direction you want to turn it, or you haven't created the hole in the ozone layer necessarily, or any of that kind of stuff. You've just understood that there is an unseen force that has certain powers, for lack of a better term, and you're directing people towards that in order to achieve a certain end. So that's a very crude example of what I'm talking about. The spiritual realm goes beyond the individual. And this is where you have the difference between intuition, which is not precognition. You see, those of us who understood what was going on back in April 2020, that wasn't precognition. That wasn't any kind of psychic ability. That was simply because we've seen these kind of things before. We've studied the way the powers that be work. So we had lots of data stored in our minds, in the subconscious and in the conscious. And due to all that data being stored, understanding the way these people work, understanding the triggers to look for in terms of the way the media presents information, the way the government is behaving and so on, the kind of tactics they use to get the results they want, problem, reaction, solution, the Hegelian dialectic, etc., etc. Now, the world of the spiritual is where you find precognition. This is where you don't actually have to have any experience with a certain person, a certain situation, or anything like that to be able to know what is happening on the other side of the world, to be able to see. That is slightly different to precognition, of course. that's a psychic ability. But the one individual I've known in my life who had very, very strong precognitive ability, she had both. She had the ability to see things in real time as they were happening, and also to see things before they happened. And she did not identify herself as a psychic. In fact, she hated being called a psychic. She was a born-again Christian, and she felt like all that kind of ability was, you know, demons, the devil, whatever. So she didn't like to talk about it, and she didn't like people calling her psychic. But if you spent enough time around her, there was just no other conclusion you could come to other than she has precognitive ability. Now, obviously, we do not understand how something like that can actually work. Science, certainly mainstream science, the science we're allowed to access as the general public, cannot explain how somebody can see things in dreams before they happen very accurately to people they know, usually, but sometimes people they don't know. There's been documentaries about people with precognitive ability or psychic ability that have helped out police departments, particularly in America. There was a movie I watched. I can't remember what movie it was. Was it Mirrors? Or I can't remember what movie it was. I want to say it was a horror movie. But one of the extras that the DVD came with was a real life documentary of a woman, either in Canada or in America somewhere, who had precognitive ability, and she worked with local law enforcement to help find a missing woman or a missing child who had been murdered, and she saw the crime in her head. And of course, because of that, she ended up being investigated, but, you know, obviously she was found innocent and all that. But yeah, she helped them locate the body and all that kind of thing, and helped them to understand how the crime went down. Now, again, I'm sure a lot of people are going to say, well, she must have had some involvement. She must have heard something. In my experience, as somebody who was formerly extremely skeptical, and I just outright dismissed any notion that somebody could be genuinely precognitive. For a certain period of my life, I did. I thought, nah, there's no way that people really have the ability to know what happens before it happens. No, some people do. I've experienced it. I've seen it for myself. Now, most of us have experienced getting a feeling about something. You know, I talked about going into the AJ Ruiz first fight. I had a feeling that something bad was going to happen to AJ. My girlfriend felt the same thing. And this feeling was so palpable that that's all me and my girlfriend were talking about all week, is I swear AJ's going to lose this fight. He shouldn't really, but I feel like he is going to. This is what we were saying to each other all week. We need to put some money down. Look at the odds. And this is not something we normally say. You know, the Povetkin fight, we didn't feel like that, which was the previous fight. All of AJ's previous fight, we never felt like that, like this. But going into the Ruiz fight, something just felt off. That right there could be the subconscious mind. It could be intuition. Or maybe it's actually precognition. Did our subconscious connect enough dots about Andy Ruiz, the style he had? I think for me, there was an element of intuition, subconscious dot connecting. But with my girlfriend, she'd never seen Andy Ruiz fight before. And she felt very, very strongly that Anthony Joshua was going to lose. So as far as I'm concerned, that was probably precognition. Most of us have experienced something like this at some point in our lives. Interestingly, the more academic people tend to be, the more academic minded, the less precognitive or psychic ability they tend to have. And because they don't have this ability for themselves, or a very, you know, weak experience of this ability, they tend not to believe that anybody else can have it. These are people who some refer to as left brain thinkers. The left brain is the hemisphere of the brain, which is thought to relate to conscious, logical thinking rather than intuitive, you know, thinking, precognitive ability, and so on. And even artistic, right? That tends to be more right brain than left brain. So left brain people tend to be very names, dates, places, facts and figures, measurements, all this kind of stuff. People that are very left brain, again, this is why you can see them at the upper echelons in academia. To truly understand this reality, you need to engage both hemispheres. Yes, you're going to need the rational, conscious, problem-solving state of mind, which is associated with the left brain, but you're also going to need the subconscious, the psychic, the precognitive, the intuitive, the artistic right brain. Now, again, I'm not a neurologist. I can't tell you. In fact, even a neurologist can't tell you exactly where the subconscious resides in the brain. They can't tell you where consciousness is in the brain at all. But what I'll say is, you have to have a holistic understanding of the human mind, reality, and so on. And therefore, you have to incorporate the intuitive as well as the conscious rational. Okay. Now, it's been my experience, I've said this countless times, that when it comes to psychic ability, things like precognition, not necessarily intuition, they call it women's intuition, but again, that's why I want to make a clear distinction between intuition and precognition and other psychic abilities. Because intuition is really just confined to the subconscious of your own brain. Whereas precognition and other psychic abilities, I have to imagine that has got to do with some other form of consciousness which transcends the individual. It's something which can connect people, which can connect maybe all living beings, not only throughout space, I'm talking about space on Earth, but also throughout time. Or else how could you see things in your head, in your mind, in dreams before they happen? There must be some kind of connection that you have which goes beyond the current time and into the future. Some kind of psychic connection. Obviously, again, we do not really understand how these things work. But if you're coming from the position I'm coming from, where you are convinced that this is a real phenomenon, and obviously you're trying to back engineer it. In my experience, women tend to have more psychic ability, precognitive ability. Okay? Not so much the dot connecting subconscious intuition, but more precognition and psychic ability. It's not to say that men don't have it as well. They do. But from what I've seen over the years and experienced, it tends to be more women. I've mentioned in the past, there's a film called Minority Report. And in that film, starring Tom Cruise, it is centered around a society in which they have something called the pre-crime department. It's like a department of the police, where they have these three psychics and they are tapped into the brains of these psychics, and they can actually, on a display, see crimes before they happen and arrest the perpetrators before the perpetrators even commit them. It's a very interesting movie. In that movie, they have three of these, they call them precogs, these psychics. Two of them are female, one of them is male. Okay? And that is indicative, as far as I'm concerned, of the fact that those who wrote the script for that movie, wrote the story for the movie, should I say, they're aware that precognition and other psychic abilities tend to be more common with women than they are with men. This is why I greatly value what they call women's intuition, right? You could call it women's precognition, women's psychic ability, if you want to be more accurate about it. I greatly value this. I constantly ask my girlfriend what she feels about certain things. And she sometimes, yeah, but I don't know anything about, I don't care whether you know anything about it. I want to know how you feel. See, my girlfriend is, I often joke with her, you know, we watched the X-Files series together. You know, she didn't grow up watching the X-Files like I did. So we watched the X-Files series together. She really liked it. And she instantly identified with the Scully character, because my girlfriend is a woman who's kind of like Scully, right? Where she's more left brain than she is right brain. She's very logical and skeptical, actually, my girlfriend. So she kind of identified with the Scully character, whereas I identify more with the Mulder character, right? So I've been working away on my girlfriend, trying to get her to connect more with her psychic abilities. Not that she's going to have any kind of crazy, amazing psychic ability different from the norm, but once you make an effort to allow your psychic ability to do what it does, once you become aware that you may have some psychic ability, then it's more likely to manifest. You're more likely to pay attention to certain feelings, instincts, and so on, right? Although, you know, maybe instinct ain't the right word, because instinct, again, could connect to the subconscious mind and intuition and so on. But yeah, whenever I speak to my girlfriend before I'm going to make any kind of decision that I'm not sure about, I'll ask her, how do you feel about this? Like, what feeling are you getting? Never mind what you think. How do you feel? And this is where society has really not necessarily gone wrong. Well, no, I'm going to say it has gone wrong, but it's been steered in the wrong direction deliberately, as far as I'm concerned. Because women have been moved away from exercising their strengths, and they have been encouraged to indulge their more negative aspects. And I guess men have been encouraged to do the same to some degree. In a rational, healthy, and I'm talking about healthy from a conscious, subconscious, and even spiritual perspective, in a healthy society, you look at the characteristics of the female and you complement those characteristics. You don't try and fight down or demonize certain characteristics that are more common among females. In the same way, you don't do that with males. There's a reason why male and female exist. We're not the same. If we were the same, there'd be no reason to have male and female. We have different abilities. In many patriarchal cultures, they really do devalue the female to the point where the female is just a breeder. That's all the female is there for, just to breed them up. You don't have to consult with them about anything. They have no real value beyond just breeding with them, cooking, cleaning the house, and that's it. I've always found my interactions with, you know, my girlfriends and women in my life to be far deeper than that. I like hearing a female perspective when a female is in the feminine energy, when she's in the feminine power. And I'm talking about the nurturing aspect. The female is not necessarily the opposite of the male, but the complement. Where the male is lacking, the female fills in the gaps and vice versa. And so for any male who is interested in understanding society, understanding the world, and understanding himself, you have to actually find women that are in their feminine energy, not women who are trying to be men, not women who are out here with a chip on their shoulder. No, women who are comfortable being women. When you're around women like that, it nourishes your soul. You feel much better about the world. Right? We're going through all kind of madness in the moment, but you feel much better about the world when you're around women like that. Real women. Rather than these Instagram hoes, these dumb bitches who think they're smart because they're in university. You know, there's just way too many of them. I mean, I put up a post a couple weeks back now, which was some type of study that had been done into the falling or a report. I'm not sure if it was a study, but it was a report by some government affiliated agency or whatever the case may be, or some kind of educational agency or whatever. I forget exactly the name. But they were talking about what anyone over a certain age would have observed in the UK and probably most other countries anyway. And that is that educational standards have been falling year on year for decades. And a pivotal moment, which is described in the article I posted a screenshot of, I think I posted a link as well. A pivotal moment was after Tony Blair got in office in the 1990s. He scrapped student grants and he introduced student tuition fees. And this changed the whole ethos of university in this country, because no longer was it about channeling the smartest, the brightest, the most talented people up into the education system to make the most out of their talent and ability and to produce the most exceptional human beings that this country can possibly produce. In a situation like that, the bar is very high. To get into university is very difficult. Most people are not going to make it. Tony Blair and his government introduced quotas whereby Blair came out and said, by a certain year, we want at least 50% of school leavers to go to university. Well, folks, there is no way you can achieve something like that unless you lower the bar. Because people are just not born with the same level of intellectual ability. They're not. Some people have a much higher ceiling than others. So if you want to push 50% of school leavers, you know, young adults going into higher education, university, you're going to have to lower the bar in order to make that happen. And that's exactly what they did. And this is why they scrapped student grants. Because before, to get into uni, you know, you had to obviously pay for equipment and all this kind of stuff, books, research material, whatever. If you didn't have the money, the government would pay for it and you wouldn't have to pay it back. Okay, the student grant. But if you are trying to increase the number of people that are going to university, you don't want to have to pay all that money out, right? If these people, because back then your parents' income would be means tested. So if your parents couldn't afford to pay the fees and whatever to send you to uni, again, you get the grant from the government. if they're trying to have 50% of young people going to uni, then the amount of money they're going to spend on the grants will be astronomical. So they scrapped the grants and they introduced the loans. And again, they opened the floodgates, lowered the standards, and this has led to people that can barely spell, barely have the basic grasp on grammar that you would expect, being let into university. Some of the dumbest people I've ever met in my life have university degrees. If you were to go back before the 90s, before the 80s, before the 70s, the 60s, I am sure you would find that the level of intellect of your average uni student 40, 50, 60 years ago was far higher than it is now. Okay? Because they only wanted the cream of the crop back then. Now they're letting any fucking Tom, Dick, and Harry in. And because of this, you have a lot of these arrogant, idiotic young people who think they're smart because they're at uni or they got a uni degree, not realizing that it's not that hard compared to how it used to be to get. Of course, there are going to be people that still can't get into uni and still can't get a uni degree because there are levels of stupid, right? But a very large percentage of people in university today would never have got into uni 30 years ago. The bar was too high for people like that. I'm not saying I necessarily would have made it, you know, 30, 40 years ago. But the point I'm making is they have produced a whole generation of people who think they're smart, but they're actually really dumb. And because the bar, this is what this report was talking about, because the bar has been lowered so much in terms of educational standards, it has massively devalued the degree. 40 years ago, if you had a degree, it meant far more about you and what you were capable of than it does now. And when you combine this fact with the fact that there are far more people, a far higher percentage of the population that have degrees now than was the case 40 or 50 years ago, this means that there's an enormous number of university graduates whose degrees are useless to them. They never end up working in the field that they studied in. You got loads of people with law degrees. I know people with law degrees. None of them are lawyers. None of them are barristers. None of them are judges. But they got law degrees. One of the primary things that they've done to the average university student, of course, you still have the elite students. You still have people in universities that are genuinely very bright and extremely intelligent. Of course, they still exist. But they are diluted by a large volume of people who are not very bright that are in uni now. And it seems to me that with a very large number of these common or garden variety university students, what the government, what the powers that be, the social engineers have sought to do is to condition them. Now, they've always conditioned people in universities. That's nothing new. But I think the level of conditioning versus trying to create, not necessarily create, but empower and train and make the most out of the best and the brightest, rather than that being the ethos of university, there's a far greater emphasis now on just brainwashing people. Obviously, they still learn certain things, right? They still are given certain knowledge depending on the degree you do. But from all the people, the young people now who are in university that I speak to, they say that the propaganda, the brainwashing in university is absolutely unbelievable at this point. It permeates virtually every facet of higher education. And you know what I'm talking about, the SJW stuff, of course, the COVID stuff now. Obviously, people are not going into university campuses as much as they were before, but even still, the propaganda's all there, the feminism, the critical race theory, all this kind of stuff. They are shoving it down students' throats, and the social engineers feel like it is absolutely imperative that the students are indoctrinated in this way. It's not really about getting the best and the brightest and taking them to the next level anymore. It's about getting a bunch of people who are really average students into university, making them think that they're the best and the brightest, giving them degrees so they have all this arrogance that when they come out into the real world, they think you can't tell them nothing. But of course, they've been indoctrinated with government propaganda. Now, one of the interesting things which a lot of these left brain types, and again, particularly in the modern age, the thing these people don't consider is the fact that when you look back through history at some of the greatest scientists, philosophers, thinkers, they were spiritual people. They were not people who were completely trapped in the left brain, where it was all, you know, facts and figures and can you weigh it, measure it, or count it? No. There was a mystical, there was a spiritual element to their thought process. If you read some of the stuff that Nikola Tesla said, clearly this man was talking about the spiritual arena. Same goes for Einstein. Same goes for many other people throughout history that made great advances in technology, science, and so on. But of course, these little jokers who come out of university today with their 2-1 in law when they can barely spell. And I'm being very serious. I've spoken to several people who can barely spell. I mean, look, if you're doing a degree in art or something like that, okay, maybe I can let that slide. But if you're doing a degree in law and you don't have a basic mastery of spelling and grammar, how on earth did you even get into university? That's insane. Law is all about language. You have to understand language and be very precise with it to be a good practitioner in law. So how on earth are they letting people in to university to do law degrees when they don't even have a decent mastery of spelling and grammar? It's just unbelievable to me that these individuals, of course, will look back at history and they'll say, oh yeah, but you know, people believed in all that nonsense back then, didn't they? Spirituality. So the likes of Einstein and Tesla, they just had to pay it all lip service. This is the way these people think. They don't stop for a second to actually contemplate, you know what, maybe if I want to try and aspire to be as bright as Tesla, as Einstein, I might want to at least contemplate the possibility that the spiritual elements they talked about were just as important as the conscious, problem-solving, rational aspect of their mind. Now, the subconscious mind thinks in pictures rather than words, because you can communicate with pictures far more quickly than you can communicate with words. When you see a picture of something, bam, it's instant. You know what that thing is. You know what it's associated with instantly. Whereas when you're taking in words, either reading it or hearing the words, there is time. Maybe it's split seconds, but there's still a certain amount of lag where your brain has to process the waveform sound information. Decode what each individual word actually means, and then put it all into the context to understand what is being said. Whereas with a picture, it's instantaneous. You look at it, a picture of a house, picture of a dog, picture of a cat, a snake, whatever. And the time it takes to process that is, okay, let me not say it's instant, which I said earlier. Maybe it's not completely instant, but it's much quicker than taking in words, right? Now, even better than, let's say, pictures, photographs, drawings, whatever, even better than that in terms of communicating into the subconscious minds, things that the subconscious mind can pick up very quickly, is symbols. And the powers that be, the esoteric thinkers, the social engineers, they understand the power of symbols. They understand that a symbol, you know, this is where the phrase comes from, the saying, a picture is worth a thousand words. It really is. But a symbol is worth a thousand pictures. Once the meaning of a symbol becomes known, that symbol alone can paint a thousand pictures. For example, the Nazis took the swastika, which is a symbol from the ancient world, and they used it as a symbol for their political party and their, you know, national socialist movement. When people see a swastika today, most people instantly feel a certain way. They think certain pictures, right? War, Hitler, Nazis, just from seeing this very basic symbol. That's how powerful a symbol can be when it has certain things associated with it. Confucius famously said, "Signs and symbols rule the world, not words nor laws." So the powers that be all around the world have known how useful symbols can be in terms of communicating things, not just among each other, but to the masses on a subconscious level. The symbols are able to bypass your conscious thought processes and communicate directly with the subconscious mind. This is why all these corporations, these media companies, and so on, have their own symbols, have their own logos. That's the whole purpose of a logo. So you can see the logo and you instantly associate a bunch of images, pictures, events, and so on, products with the logo. Bypasses the conscious, goes straight to your subconscious. A certain symbol might make you feel angry. A certain symbol might make you feel hungry, might make you feel afraid, might make you feel happy, might make you feel comfortable, irritable, and so on. Now, I'm definitely no expert on Jewish mysticism, Kabbalah, Gematria, because Gematria, of course, is a number system, a word number association system, which has been practiced by certain people within the Jewish community for hundreds or thousands of years. And there are still people in the modern world in positions of power, apparently, who are practicing Gematria and many other things from the Kabbalah. What I can tell you is that symbols which we think of in a certain way, like let's say the swastika, are charged because of what they're associated with. They're charged with a certain type of energy. But the symbol itself may not be innately negative. It's simply what the symbol has been charged with, or the things it's been associated with. So when you're coming from an Abrahamic perspective, and I've got the most amount of respect for the Abrahamic religions, but a lot of people who are coming from the Christian perspective, the Islamic perspective, they might see certain symbols, certain numbers, and instantly jump to the conclusion that this is evil because of the association that certain symbols and numbers have within their religion. But I am of the mind that a lot of these symbols and numbers are not necessarily innately evil or bad. They've just been taken by bad and evil people for whatever esoteric reasons and used for bad in the past. I am not a practitioner of using these kind of symbols and all that. I don't know enough about it to possibly try and put those shoes on. Certainly not at this stage of my life. So I'll leave all that alone. But I'm also not somebody that's just going to see certain numbers, certain symbols, and automatically say, okay, this person must be evil because they're putting up this symbol or these numbers. Now, of course, there are going to be evil people that use all kind of different symbols and numbers. But those who are far more well-versed in this arena than me, I'm open to the possibility they could be using those symbols and numbers for good. That's what I'll say about that. You know, my attitude towards the Abrahamic religions, especially at this point, is solidarity. I'm not trying to convert. I'm not trying to become a Christian, a Muslim, or a Jew. But I know enough about those religions to understand that their way of life and their ideology is infinitely preferable to the ideology that the powers that be are trying to indoctrinate the public with. Now, recently, we've had the death of Prince Philip. He died at the age of 99, on the 99th day of the year, on the 9th day of the month. And immediately after his death, they said there would be 30 days of mourning, which takes us through, of course, to the 9th of May. There's another 9. So the 9s are all over the place. Now, there's two schools of thought on this. One school of thought, and I'm talking about within esoteric circles, within the alternative research community. One school of thought is that they announced his death on that particular date, knowing that all the 9s lined up in this way, which would mean that he either died on a different date, but they waited to announce it on that date because they wanted to harness whatever energy from announcing it on a particular date. Because from my research over the years, from what I've observed and looked at, many of these aristocratic and elite families are very much into things like gematria, astrology, and so on. I've spoken in the past about how Prince William was induced prematurely on the summer solstice. And the official reason for doing this was to fit in with Prince Charles's polo schedule. I mean, it's dangerous to induce a child. There are risks that come with inducing a baby. Normally, a child is only induced when there's something wrong, either with the mother or with the child in terms of health. So it becomes dangerous for the child to remain in the womb. That's why they induce certain children. Whereas with William, there was nothing wrong with him. He was perfectly healthy. Diana was perfectly healthy, but yet he was induced to fit in with Charles's polo schedule. and it just so happened to be on the summer solstice. Yeah, I don't buy it. And I also don't buy this idea that Prince Philip just coincidentally died on the 9th of April, where all these nines line up at 99 years of age, the 99th day. I don't buy that that's a coincidence. So it's either something that the royals have planned to announce on that day. Maybe he died a week earlier, 2 weeks earlier. I don't know. And they announced it on that day because of the occult significance of doing so. Or, and I've heard Thomas Sheridan alluding to this, I've also heard a couple other people, they've actually said that or suggested that these numbers that we get associated with certain events are actually the numbers in the Matrix. You know, in the Matrix movie, where they're in the real world and they look at the computer screens, you don't actually see any visual of the Matrix. All you see is binary ones and zeros, code. And so when we get these numbers associated with certain events, people dying, the 9/11 incident, I mean, that's a perfect example. This is actually the universe speaking to us. This is actually the code of the universe revealing itself, just like the code of the Matrix that the people would see on the screens. This is the code of the universe, a mathematical code. At least the way in which our brains decode the code is as numbers, right? So rather than the royals planning it to be that way, it's actually the source code of this matrix that we live in revealing itself. And when something significant happens, which is going to shape the course or alter the course of our reality, the code is going to be different. The code is going to be unusual around these events. Strange numbers are going to pop up far beyond what could be counted as coincidence. So I'm going to play an excerpt of an interview with a guy called Rick Clay, who died many years ago. He was only a young man when he died. They say he died of suicide, you know, killed himself. But he was in the alternative research community, and he started off taking some of the work of Ian Crane. You know, he credited Ian Crane for this, but that's what started him off. And he extrapolated and he built upon the work of Ian Crane with regards to the numerology, the gematria associated with certain significant events. And the clip I'm about to play is him breaking down the numbers associated with 9/11. And he also did a breakdown of the 2012 London Olympics, which is equally fascinating. So let me play the 9/11 clip.
And so then you like start moving into the numerology of it. And for instance, if you get 11/11 and you multiply it by 11/11, you get the number 1234321, which is a pyramid. Okay, so you've got a pyramid numerology that you can get out of the 11/11.
Backtrack on that a little bit and take it a little bit slower for us again.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if you've got the time code 11/11 and you multiply it by the same thing, so 11/11 times 11/11,
yeah,
you get the number 1234321.
Okay.
So
yeah,
if you imagine that as a visual, you've got a pyramid.
So yeah, one step up, that's number one. Then we have two, that's two steps up. Is that, yeah, is that what you're going at here?
Yeah, yeah. So essentially, like, because you've got the 1234321, if you were to plot that on a graph,
right,
on an X and a Y, you'd have a pyramid.
Interesting.
So and the same decreases. So if you've got 111, you times it by 111, you get 12321. You get a pyramid, whichever way you look at it, anything with a base of one.
Interesting.
And so then, if you look at the 11 itself, and in binary, an 11 stands for a 3. So obviously you've got a trinity out of it. Do you know what I mean? So if you were to convert to binary, it would mean it'd be 3. So essentially, then if you look at this idea of the Trinity with it. You know, 33rd degree Masons and the number 33 that goes around. Obviously, if you turn that into the Trinity and you divide 33 by 3, you get 11.
That's interesting.
So you start like seeing these 11s, as I'm saying. When you look at it in an astrological sense, with the precession of the equinoxes and the 26,000 year cycle of the Earth wobbling through the 12 signs of the zodiac, we're said to be moving into the new age of Aquarius.
Mm.
And Aquarius is the 11th astrological sign. 1972 Olympics in Munich. Mm. Now, funnily enough, these were the world's first stage for global terrorism. You know, the very first global, declared as global terrorism, the first act was in the 1972 Munich Olympics.
Indeed, yeah.
And on these Olympics, there were 11 Israelis killed. So we've got the number 11 there.
Mm.
And they were killed by a group called Black September, which is obviously the ninth month. So it's obviously a 9/11 you've got there.
Yeah.
And that particular Olympics were host to 121 countries, which is 11 times 11.
Mm.
So you've got a significant event there with first like global stage for terrorism, as it is. So then you move on to recent events and you get to September the 11th, 2001. Right, and you realize that the building was stood like an 11, the two towers stood like an 11
indeed.
And then you've got 9/11, which is 9 plus 1 plus 1, which is 11. And then you realize that September the 11th was 111 days until the end of the year.
Mm.
And then you start thinking about the first plane that hit the World Trade Center, and it was flight 11.
There you go. Yeah,
right. And the total number of crew on flight 11 was 11. And then you look into it further, and the New York State was the 11th state of the US Constitution.
Mm.
So then you start thinking about, was 9/11 an event that was either, was it, as Jose Argelis would put it, was it an inevitable event, inevitable event? You know, was it designed by the universe for it to happen as it did?
Yeah.
You look into it further, and World Trade Center commenced building in 1966, and finished building it in 1977, so it took 11 years to create as well.
Yeah.
So you can move on from that, forget all that for the time being, and then you can get to September the 11th in history. And on September the 11th, 1990, at 9:09 p.m., that's 11 years prior to 9/11, George Bush Sr. made his very first speech entitled "Towards a New World Order" in the UN, at the UN.
Hmm.
So this was 11 years prior. And then if you take that back 60 years, so you go back to September the 11th, 1941, you'll realise that 60 years to 9/11, that was when the soil was broken for the Pentagon.
Pentagon, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so you've got this date, September the 11th, again running through this kind of, the nasty war machine of America, if you want to call it that.
Exactly.
And so then basically, there's something that happened much further back in time than that, and there's a book written in 1981, and it was called The Birth of Christ Recalculated, and it was written by a guy called Ernest L. Martin, and he claims to have calculated the exact date of Jesus Christ's birthday based on celestial charts for that era.
Yeah.
Basically, he's worked out with the famous Star of Bethlehem, which was, he worked out that essentially Jesus Christ was born on September the 11th, 3 BC. This book was released in 1981.
Mm-hmm.
So, we've got another date there.
I think that is, sorry to interrupt there, but I think that's actually a key area to why we potentially are seeing so many things oriented around the 9 and the 11 September.
Definitely. I mean, when it comes into other significant events, for instance, when think about America and NASA and stuff, the very first shuttle that got to the moon was Apollo 11.
Yeah, there you go.
And then, for instance, in Great Britain, I think it's celebrated around the world actually, but on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, we celebrate Remembrance Day, in which, we honour our war dead, but it's on an 11/11, and it's basically, the Queen and a load of other people taking poppies to a cenotaph, which is an obelisk, essentially.
Yeah.
So, little strange events going on all over the place.
Indeed.
I mean, talking about the Queen, moving into royalty, and this is where, I'll lead much deeper into royalty later on, but basically, if you look into the history of the word crown and the royal crown, The word crown was derived from Anglo-French word called caroon, which is derived from Latin for corona. But the year that the word crown, you know, was first established was in the year 1111.
Huh, really? That's interesting.
Right.
Huh,
so,
wow.
You know, I mean, you can't just say that these are coincidences, all of these things that are kind of like connected up. And I get to a point where, you know, at first I thought they were coincidences, but then you think, you know, yeah, what is this thing called chance?
Yeah.
You know, what is it?
Indeed.
So anyhow, that's the groundwork for 11.
All right, I'm going to leave it there. Hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode. Apologies that it was a little bit late. You're still going to get 2 hours, minimum of 2 hours of content this week. This is just an hour or so, which rolled over from last week because I never got it done. So yeah, catch you guys on the next one.